Generally, what I want to discuss is the relation between fluid dynamics, hydrodynamics, both relativistic and non-relativistic, with gravity. It's a kind of a spin-off of ADS-CFT, although, in fact, you can disentangle it from ADS-CFT completely. And this was done, in fact, in the past under the name the membrane paradigm. For some reason that I will explain to you, actually, that stopped at that time. The basic reason was because those guys were discussing asymptotically flat spaces. And in this case, in that case, the correspondence between fluid dynamics, real fluids, and gravity is not working that well. But apparently for asymptotically ADS, it works much nicer. In fact, there are some deep reasons there, because also asymptotically ADS is much better suited to study condensed matter systems and various other systems that are related to the real world. So somehow maybe we should be happy that asymptotically ADS spaces are related to all kinds of phenomena in physics in a much better way than asymptotically flat spaces. So one way to start the discussion is the following. Suppose you have some very clever equation that relates ADS to CFT. Now here you've got strong group working on n equal to 4 as an example of that. And in some sense, we will be able, maybe in the future, to make a precise definition of what this equation is. But for the moment, one can think about n equal to 4 related to gravity or string theory and asymptotically flat spaces. Of course, this is a conformal case. But then you can ask yourself what happens if you want to introduce temperature. So this, for instance, could be an n equal to 4 example, but I'm not insisting on that. Now, what you do is, suppose you want to introduce a temperature which is different than zero. So it's a thermal field theory. And this we can also do in some way on the ADS side, and it becomes a black hole or a black brain. And then you can ask yourself, suppose I want to do the next step, and I want to take the temperature to be a function of coordinates, x and t. And therefore, I want to go away from equilibrium. Now, you can try to go away from equilibrium, far from equilibrium, globally, locally, etc. Or you can ask yourself, suppose I want to have still some derivative expansion. And here, normally, what you do is in not just temperature, you can also boost the system. And therefore, you add some more degrees of freedom, which are some four velocities. And by mu, I really mean the usual thing. Okay, mu would be this gamma and gamma beta. Then what this gives you is some kind of deformation of the black brain. And this allows you somehow to have a correspondence between these two systems in a way that we'll try to make more precise later. And then the next step, you can ask yourself, what if I take the non-relativistic limit? And the non-relativistic limit, that means that you are considering velocities which are much, much smaller than the speed of light. It turns out that here at this step, you're going to get just the ordinary Navier-Stokes equations. And this will correspond to some limit of that black brain and will be some kind of a geometry that we can define later. And therefore, it relates ordinary Navier-Stokes equations of fluid dynamics with some geometrical background. And in this case, it's actually in a rather precise sense that general relativity equations being nonlinear in some way contain the Navier-Stokes equations, and in some way by this I would mean that it will be the constrained equations of general relativity that are equivalent to the Navier-Stokes equations. So that's basically one way to go in this chain of logic, and there's a large group of people who are working on that, that to a large extent started with the work with Baimin Wala and various people. And this is a way to present it like this is to really start to think about ADS-CFT and from there go to this limit. On the other hand, there was another development in this field of relating gravity to fluid dynamics, and it was a long time ago. That was related by, it was used to call the membrane paradigm. And there were many people associated with it, Thorne, Price, others. And in particular, there was an interesting work by Damour, starting with his PhD thesis on that thing. And what those guys were asking themselves was, suppose I want to ask to study the evolution equations of the horizon of a black hole. And by evolution equations, you really mean projection of Einstein's equations on the horizon, which are called Gauss-Godazzi equations. And they were trying to understand these Gauss-Godazzi equations. And ask what they are. And they are basically the projections of Einstein's equations on the, or the constraint Einstein equations on the horizon. And they realized that this looks like fluid dynamics equations. Not quite. It didn't really quite work. If you look there, it looks like some kind of fictitious fluid dynamics equations with all kinds of negative bulk viscosities and stuff like that. And there was a reason why this really didn't work. And the reason that this didn't really work was because in asymptotically flat spaces, for instance, the case they were considering asymptotically flat four-dimensional space, the horizon topology is a sphere. While here, the topology of the horizon is planar. So, in fact, there was no real separation of scales in the sense that I will explain, that allows you to do a hydrodynamic expansion. And this is, you can say it in a rather general way, black holes in asymptotically flat spaces with horizon topologies which are compact, they have thermodynamics properties, but they do not have hydrodynamics. But the ones in ADS do have a hydrodynamic description. So that's roughly the story. And I think I will first start from the last part here. I want to explain to you a little bit what are the issues that are involved with Navier-Stokes equations. What are actually two main open problems in this field? And then we can proceed upwards and get to the rest. Are there any questions on this so far? Okay, so let me start by with the Navier-Stokes equations. And the Navier-Stokes equations are just nonlinear evolution equations, dTvi plus Vj, Dj, Vi. And if you want, you can introduce also some external force. And there is another incompressibility condition like this. So what are the Navier-Stokes equations? So there is a V. V is a vector, is the vector field. Vi of x and t, where I can go from 1 up to d in general. And you can study this equation in general d dimensions. And this is the velocity or the flow velocity of this fluid. Okay, so this is the velocity. Now, you can study these equations in arbitrary dimension. But there are actually two interesting dimensions which are relevant for experiments. These are d equal to 2 and d equal to 3. This is, you have experimental results. Otherwise, it's a mathematical problem. Interesting, but still, you cannot connect it to experiment. Now, this part that you see here is nothing but d by dt of vi, okay? And what you are actually seeing is the F equal ma. This is the F equal ma equation, where the F, this part, is the part, is the pressure, is the force of the other fluid elements on the particular fluid element that you are considering. So P here is the pressure. And this knee here is viscosity, so it's called the kinematic viscosity. And this equation is just nothing but F equal ma equation. Now, where is the m here? Because of this incompressibility, we are studying the incompressible case. In the incompressible case, the mass density is constant. And therefore, we basically divided by it. So, in the incompressible case, the rho, which is the mass density, is constant. So normally you should have had here d by dt of rho vi, but rho is constant, and so we divided by it. And that is why this kinematic viscosity is actually divided by the density. It's the viscosity divided by the density. Now, the incompressibility condition, so it's not necessary to study incompressible fluids, but actually those are the ones which are maybe the most interesting and difficult. And let me say a couple of things about them. So first of all, when you want to get incompressible fluid, there is a regime of velocities that you are studying, and this is the velocities which are much smaller than the speed of sound. So there is the speed of sound, this is V squared, is just d of the pressure by the density. And when you are considering velocities which are much, much smaller than the speed of sound, you are getting incompressible fluids because the sound waves are the compression modes. Now, because this is also smaller than the speed of light, incompressible fluids are always non-relativistic. So if you want to study incompressible fluids, they are always non-relativistic. So, for instance, if we will later discuss rig physics, and rig physics is relativistic fluid dynamics, then you will not have the incompressibility conditions. They will be compressible. Compressible fluids are different. They have shockwave solutions and all kinds of stuff like that. So this is then this is the Navier-Stokes equation for the incompressible case. Now, to generalize it for non-relativistic compressible is also very simple. Basically, this equation, for instance, just comes from dt of rho vi plus some d, no, that will be dt of rho plus di of vi. This is this equation, and the other one we can also generalize. Typically, what you get from the non-relativistic limit of these CFTs is the Navier-Stokes equations with the incompressibility condition for reasons that I will explain. Okay, so is that clear? What is the equation? Okay, so now this equation has a dimensionless parameter, which is of much importance, and it is the ratio between this term and this term. And this dimensionless parameter controls the dynamics of the system. It is called the Reynolds number. Okay, so the Reynolds number is a dimensionless quantity, and it's the ratio between this quantity and this quantity. Now, what do we see here? We have two velocities, so let's write it as velocity squared. There is here a derivative, so we divide it by some length scale. Now here there is a viscosity, there are two derivatives, and there is a V. So we can write it as V times L squared, and here also there is some mu. And then when we get rid of these guys, you're going to get V times L divided by now, what are the quantities here? So ni is this viscosity. It's a property of the fluid. V is a characteristic velocity differences in the problem. And L is also some characteristic scale of this fluid. Okay, so V is, let's say, characteristic velocity. It's actually velocity difference, but and the same story with L, which is some characteristic length. Now, what is known about the physics of this is actually known from experiment and from numerics. There are no really analytical results in the regime that we are going to study, because the system is very far from being integrable. It's in fact very far from being in equilibrium. But the Reynolds number is the parameter that tells you in which regime you are. And now the experimental and the numerical evidence shows that if the Reynolds number is smaller than one, you get something which is called very smooth flow. It's called laminar flow. So it's not very interesting, and this you can also study analytically. If the Reynolds number starts to be, let's say, bigger than one, but up to 100 or something, the system shows already some complex structure, which is called chaotic, but it's not yet what we call turbulence. When the Reynolds number is of the order of 10 to the power 3 or even more, then this is called turbulence. Now, this is not a very good definition because I didn't tell you what does it mean, turbulence, but I will show you in a second what turbulent flows exhibit as their features that have to be explained. And this is the most interesting part, namely to understand this regime of very high Reynolds number. The physics there is very, very complicated. It's very different than what we are used to in field theory. All the tools that we are aware of do not work here, for reasons that I will explain in a second. So this is the regime we are interested in, but the funny thing about nature is that most of the flows are turbulent. And the reason is the following. If you take, for instance, the viscosity of water, that's something like 10 to the minus 6 meters squared over a second. Same for air, is roughly the same. Air is around 10 to the 5 or 1.5 times 10 to the minus 5. The air is larger, which is kind of surprising because we divide by the density. Now, if I go to this number and I put here 10 to the minus 6, you see that whatever the numbers I'm putting here, I'm always getting a very large number. I mean, suppose you take some small river, average river. So what will be the Reynolds number? So we'll be here 10 to the minus 6, and here some scales of the river, velocity and length, I don't know, maybe order 10, 1. So it will be like 10 to the 7. But it's not just that. Already if you run or if you swim, because this number is so small, you'll always get this 10 to the 3 or 10 to the 4, and you always get into turbulent regime. So actually, unlike what one may expect, this regime is the one that you always see in nature. So actually, the other ones are very difficult to get. So this is actually very generic in nature. So it's kind of, let's say, confusing that we cannot, we know so little about the regime, which is the most common. For comparison, I can tell you that if you look at trig, for instance, now when we think about RIC, we think there is some explosion and some very complicated fluid, etc. So when we get there, relativistic hydrodynamics, I'll show you that actually the Reynolds number there is very small. In fact, the fluid there is very, very smooth. And because what will sit in the denominator instead of this will be this eta over S. But eta over S is not so small. It's like 1 over 4 pi or something like that. It's not 10 to the minus 6. So actually, the complicated RIC experiment or LSS experiment does not show any turbulence, while ordinary stuff in nature do show that. Okay, are there questions on that?
I mean, is there some phenomena that happens?
Yeah, I will tell you. There is a, let's call it a phenomenology, which will have to, which explains how did you enter to the turbulence. And this is the phenomenology that is the thing you need to explain in order to solve turbulence. That's what I'm going to discuss here. There are some other ways to see that, when you just look at pictures, for instance, and if you take some symmetric source, or at the beginning when it's a laminar flow, you see all the symmetries of the source, then after that some of them are broken and this regime breaks it completely. But the true statement is there is no precise definition of turbulence except properties of turbulence that we have to explain, which is what we have to explain. Now, what people realized in turbulence was, when they were studying turbulence, is that actually it makes no sense to study a single solution of the equations. I mean, at the end of the day, you could say, okay, you have an equation, put initial conditions, solve for it, and that's it. Okay, you can do that numerically, but it turned out that this makes no sense because you change a little bit the initial conditions, you get a totally different result. So there is no way to characterize this regime just by a single solution trying to solve. So then people move to statistical approach. And that's actually the way people are thinking about turbulence, and there are many ways to discuss statistics. At the end, it will turn out to become a problem, which is at the level of a complicated nonlinear field theory, but with no expansion parameter. So it resembles a little bit, if you wish, QCD at strong coupling. There is no expansion parameter there, except there is the N of the SUN. Actually, there is one expansion parameter I did not discuss. I'll discuss it maybe later. There is one expansion parameter. It's the dimension of the equation. So you can use the velocity field at dimension D. Then you can take D to infinity and expand in one over D. Okay, that's the only expansion parameter that exists. Now, how do you define statistics? There are various ways to define it. One way is the following. Suppose you look at a fluid and you measure the velocity at two points. So let's say this is the velocity at the point X and this is the velocity at the point Y. So let's say X minus Y is some vector R, and R is. Now, what you can do is the following. One way to do that is measure the difference between any two points that are separated by the same fixed distance R. Or you just move around the flow. So you take two points, you measure, etc. And you sum all of that. So what you're actually doing, you are taking VI at X minus VI at Y. So let's call it delta VI. And you calculate correlation functions. Now, what type of correlation functions? So in one type of correlation function is, for instance, you take VI at X minus VI at Y. You dot it with the vector difference R, RI over R. So just to get the index, sum over the indices, and you average over all the points in the fluid. And you ask,
what are the properties of this correlation function? So I can, at the end of the day, shift it to be something like that. I can write it VR at R, and this to zero. Sometimes you'll see that. Now it turned out that there is a universality. And the universality works like that. So this actually, better to put it, N. So there will be N moments here. And before I tell you what is the answer, I have to tell you something about the scaling regime. So what people discovered, again, it's numerically and experimentally, the following properties, that if you look at this difference R, smaller, smaller than some capital scale L, and bigger, bigger than some little scale L. This is called inertial range. And the two scales are the following. This is the viscous scale. So this is the small scale where there is this molecular physics that creates dissipation. And this is the big scale. For instance, this is the scale where you excited the system. Let's say it's the scale of the force that excited the system. If you look at correlation functions, but the velocity differences are such that R is much, much smaller than L and much, much bigger than L, it turns out that the physics, there's a universal physics that doesn't depend on the properties of the force, whether you threw a box into the water or something else. Doesn't depend on the details of the fluid, whether it's water or something else, I don't know, honey, whatever, air, doesn't. And the results here are universal. They scale like R to some exponent psi n. And this psi n, they are anomalous exponents. They are real numbers. And those are the ones that you need to calculate. So I will tell you in a second what are other properties, but this is the problem of turbulence. When people say, we would like to solve turbulence, that's what they mean. They mean, show us how to calculate all this infinite number of quantities here that show this universal behavior. And this universal behavior has been measured. So moments like this has been measured up to order 10 or even more, and numerically even more than that. And they are known, and they depend on the dimension. They are different in two dimensions and three dimensions. The main problem is in three dimensions. So now the numbers here, of the coefficients here are not universal. They depend on the properties of the system or all kinds of the scales in the problem. But those numbers are universal. This shows, in this regime, you have scale invariants, you have rotation invariants, you have isotropy, translation invariants, isotropy, all the symmetries that you would like. It's not a conformal, it's not a conformal field theory. It doesn't show conformal behavior, but it has this interesting behavior. And now, these anomalous exponents are what you need to calculate. So in a sense, you can think about this as an equivalent to the problem that we like in Young-Mills. Calculate the mass spectrum of globules. Also, lots of real numbers. There is no real expansion parameter. The situation here, I think, is even worse than that. Because this system is very far from equilibrium. So all the usual tools that we know from quantum field theory, they never work. They don't work here. So for instance, this is not something that we can hope to calculate using ADS-CFT. It is a totally different game now. Okay, so now what is known about these anomalous exponents? So, yes. Yes, yes. So basically, actually, it's good, because I was about to tell you other ways to do that, but One way to average is that you take the fluid, you take two points which are separated by a fixed distance r, and then you measure the difference. Then you move to other two points which are also separated only by r, and you measure, and then you do over all of them. That's one way. A second way is to just take two points which are separated by r, whatever you like, but change randomly the initial conditions, or put a random force. It turns out that all those types of statistics give you the same answer. Actually, this is independent of time. When you enter into the regime of the inertial range, it's a steady state result. It doesn't depend on time. You can do it different times, you'll get the same answer. You can fix them at a point at a given time, but if you will change the time in that inertial range, it doesn't matter. The result is, actually, the system enters a steady state regime. That's the important point about it. You don't get the exponents. You don't get the exponents. You actually need to what people call fully developed turbulence. You need to get to the turbulent regime in order to see that. This universal behavior shows itself only at very high Reynolds number. In between, it doesn't show itself. So alternatively, as I said, you can just put a random force, but then you don't need to sum over everything. Just take any two points that you like, but average with respect to the force. That's another. Now, in fact, there is a. So the first, or maybe the most important thing in this field, or result in this field, is actually due to a mathematician. This is called Kolmogorov theory. So it's by Kolmogorov in 1941. Sometimes this theory, you see, it's called K41. It's Kolmogorov from 41. So it's a little bit embarrassing, right? It's so many years ago. But actually, Kolmogorov theory is basically just dimensional analysis. So he had some picture in mind of how the fluid behaves. And this is sometimes called this eddies picture. So he said, okay, I have these big eddies that splits to smaller eddies, etc., until I reach the viscous scale. And then there is dissipation. This is the scale L that we started. So the system, if you will probe it, you see that it's big eddies splitting due to instability to smaller and smaller eddies, etc. But then he said, if you are in the inertial range, so he postulates in the inertial range, then what will happen is that there is no dissipation. You are far from here. And the only physics of this breaking is that you break, but you transmit, you keep the flux of energy going from one scale to the other. And so the only thing that happens in this cascade, this is sometimes also cascade, is that energy flux goes from one. And then he uses dimensional analysis, and let me just do it quickly. Dimensional analysis means the following. If you think about this delta V to the power 3, this correlation function, then you ask yourself what quantities can I put it here in which have dimension? But since the only quantity that he wants to have here is energy flux, and energy flux is basically V squared divided by time. So the, let's call it epsilon, that will have dimensions of length squared over time cubed. Because it's just V squared over time. It's energy flux. So then if you put here this epsilon, then the only thing you can add is some dimensionful, some length scale, and therefore he concluded that the exponent for 3 is 1. And if you keep this dimensional analysis, you see immediately what he will tell you. He will tell you that psi n is nothing but n over 3. This is called Kolmogorov scaling. So it's dimensional analysis, nothing more than that. Sometimes you see it a little bit differently. Sometimes you see energy Kolmogorov energy scaling, you don't see it like that, but you see something which is very similar. You will see the two-point function. So the two-point function will go like that. So according to Kolmogorov, basically he will tell you that delta V scales like R to the power 1 over 3. This dimension 1/3. And therefore, if you will look at the energy, this will be like correlation functions of delta V squared. That will scale like R to 2/3. And then what they do is normally do a Fourier transform, E of K, which goes like integral of E to the I KR, R to the 2/3. Yeah. And then you see that it scales like K to the power minus 5/3. So this is called also Kolmogorov scaling. Sometimes you see it like that. But it's just dimensional analysis. And now the question is, okay, how does it compare with experiment, this dimensional analysis? And what turned out to be is that it doesn't agree, except for the particular value of n equal to 3, where this psi n is 1. Okay? So psi 3, which is 1, it agrees with experiment. All the rest do not agree. And it looks like that. If you plot schematically psi n as a function of n, let's say 1, 2, 3, etc. So the Kolmogorov scaling will go like that, while the actual result looks something like that. Then it starts to deviate. And they agree. For some reason here, I'll give you a better reasoning, I think, for that, why it agrees there, but it agrees at n equal to 3, and otherwise, it doesn't work. So another is the puzzle is what could be a scheme that you can use in order to calculate those numbers. Let me tell you what are these numbers in black hole physics, okay? Which is kind of cute because it tells you if I borrow the results from turbulence, I can tell you something very interesting about gravity. So, when we will get to black hole physics, you will see the following, that actually, suppose this is a brain, this is the black brain, and this is the equilibrium, and then suppose I excited it, so this is the horizon at somewhere, this is the horizon of the brain, this is the equilibrium, and here it deviates from equilibrium. This piece here, this part here, will be the pressure. And the normal here will be roughly the velocity. What do I mean by roughly? So, first of all, this will be like a five-dimensional space. So the normal will be a normal in five dimensions. So let's call a normal NA to be something in the radial direction, something in the time direction, something in the X direction. Okay? So, yes?
What's the wiggly line?
So this is the black brain at finite temperature, so it's equilibrium. And then I excited it such that now the temperature is a function of x and t. So the horizon of the black hole before relaxing to equilibrium will get into some wiggly situation. So you can call it, you can say this is t zero, and let's say this is t of x and t. That's in the relativistic case. When I'll take the non-relativistic limit, that will translate to the pressure. So the physics of the black hole will be like you have a black brain, it's nice, it's like this smooth fluid. Then you throw something on it, it starts to excite, gets into this turbulence regime. Then after some time, it will relax again to equilibrium. And so this is the pressure, and this is the velocity, this is NA. Well, now NR is 0, this is 1, and this is VI. So roughly, the normal to the horizon is the velocity of the fluid, and the deviation from equilibrium, that's the pressure. By the way, I didn't tell you, but the pressure in Navier-Stokes is actually not independent quantity of the velocity. I'll show you in a second. It's not really independent. It's the velocity that determines everything. Now, what this tells you about this complicated wiggly line, this horizon of the black hole, of the black brain, is that this experimental result tells you that if I was able to measure here the velocity differences and sum them up, do the statistics on the horizon, the black brain should exhibit these funny numbers, xi n here. Now, I find this really rather intriguing, that some black hole or black brain in ADS, if I was able to do this calculation, I would get these numbers that those guys are measuring on real fluids or tabletop experiments with optics. But that's what it says, because we will see that these equations that determine this horizon dynamics are exactly the Navier-Stokes equations. So I can take any result from experiment and translate it to, or from numerics and translate. So that's, by the way, the reason why I told you that the pressure is not independent of the velocity is because if you look at this equation, dTVI plus VJ DJ VI equal minus DIP plus if I take a divergence with respect to I here of this whole equation, and I use the fact that it's incompressible, then this term will drop. This term will drop. And what you will get is that the Laplacian of P is minus DIVJ VJVI. So they are actually not independent. But they are non-locally related. Yes.
Perturbation is not the normal vector. At rest, the normal vector is just in the radial direction.
So at rest, you mean?
T0.
You mean constant the equilibrium, the constant temperature?
Yeah.
Well, if the velocity is 0, it will be 0, right?
The normal vector?
If the velocity is 0, this component will be 0.
Right.
It's a question, by the way, it's a choice of coordinates that has that.
I mean, the reason there is zero at the first component is that we expand around something that is 1, 0, 0, 0, and then this is...
It's a choice of coordinates. You're worried why it's constant not 1? Why it's not nr is 1 and the rest is 0? Why it's not in the radial direction? If the velocity is 0, this goes away. Now you are worried why, for instance, it's not 1, 0, 0, 0 or something like that?
Because at T0, I would say that the normal vector is 1, 0, 0, 0.
Yeah, so this was said. This is related to, we'll get to that. This is related to a choice of coordinates. One, that we are not using the Schwarzschild, but actually the so-called Eddington-Finkelstein. And second is the, how well did you locate the horizon? But it will be constant vector when there is no velocity. Or when the velocity is constant, it's also constant. It's not constant when this is a function of t, right? Then it's not constant anymore. So that's the case we will be sort of interested. Anyway, this is so the fact that the pressure is independent, it has some importance, but it's not locally related. You have to invert this Laplacian in order to get it as a function of the velocity. Okay, so this is... this is the problem, the most important problem. In fact, I can tell you a couple of more things about it. And the first thing that we noticed when we started to think about it, by the way, it's got nothing to do with gravity, is that why don't we ask questions about universality in compressible turbulence? Because people discuss only this Eddy's picture, and those Eddy's picture do not exist there. It turned out that actually... We could rederive this result in another way, and then we could get all kinds of new correlation functions that can be measured. And that was kind of a surprising result, to see that after 70 years you can improve on that. So I will explain to you how this is done. In fact, it's rather simple and trivial. It just shows that this exponent being 1 has got nothing to do with this picture, but it's more like related to the fact that the equations that describe hydrodynamics or Navier-Stokes equation are just conservation laws. But, okay, but before I do that, let me tell you a couple of other things. One simple case you could ask yourself to study is D equal to 1. Now, D equal to 1, that means, 0 plus 1, so 1 plus 1 dimensions. I only can count here the space dimensions. Now, here there is a problem, right? Because if I use the incompressibility condition, it will be dx vx equal to 0, and that will make it trivial. So you cannot really have incompressible. But there is an interesting toy model for that, which is called Burger's turbulence. And that simple example, you have the equation dTv, there's only one component, plus V dxV equal mi dx squared V. This is the equation. Now, a couple of interesting things. One, it's not known how to get this equation from gravity. So here I can give you already an open problem. Nobody solved it. Open problem here is, what is the dual gravity? A dual gravitational description of this equation. When I'll get it to the equation, you will see why it's difficult to get it. Okay, I can explain it actually now. The problem is the following. Gravity is relativistic. So we have to do something in order to get non-relativistic equations. When we do that, we have to take a non-relativistic limit. But typically, the non-relativistic limit always gets us with this incompressibility condition. An incompressibility condition is not something we can allow here. So there has to be another way to get it. Nobody managed so far. But this model is actually integrable. You can calculate its exponents as a function of n, this psi n, and they show the following behavior. When you get to this n equal to 1, 2, etc., it shows, it gets like this up to 1, and then here. Now, of course, this is a little bit weird for you, because what do I mean by moments which are less than that, but it can be defined. But anyway, all the exponents are 1. So psi n is 1 for this model. They are all of them. And it can be calculated. Now, how do you calculate them? What turned out to be dominant in this model are shock waves. And shock waves, the way they contribute is that they basically show you a jump in the velocity field. So I can give you a heuristic derivation of that, but there is a more precise, but what I'm telling you is, I'm going to tell you is actually the right thing, just you have to be a little bit more precise. So this system is dominated by shock waves, and shock waves are basically jumps in velocity, right? If there is a velocity, function of time or x, it doesn't matter, and there is a jump from V1 to V2, this is called the shock wave. Now, when you have a shock wave, and you schematically try to calculate a correlation function to some power n, the dominant behavior here, when you jump, is just going to be delta x. And this is roughly the reason why when you have a dominance by shock waves, you will get exponents which are 1. And this has been proven here to be correct. And now there is a conjecture, which we put with certain support for it, but it's never been proven, is that Navier-Stokes equations, also it's an open problem. I don't know whether it's true or not, but there are some support for it. Navier-Stokes equation, when D goes to infinity, the dimension goes to infinity, has all the xi n equal 1. Roughly, the reasons that we had for that explanation was because the incompressibility condition becomes irrelevant, and also the pressure becomes irrelevant, and therefore it looks like Burger's equation. And it actually has support from numerics. It's like when we calculate globules, we calculate for SU2, SU3, SU4, etc. Those guys can do Navier-Stokes equation for d equal to 3, 4, etc. And then what they see is that the exponents tend to be 1. So it's an open problem, and it's actually an important problem, because if you manage to do that, then there is a well-defined 1 over d expansion one can do. Now, in the past, people thought that when d goes to infinity, you're going to get just Gaussian model. And Gaussian models are very, of course, different from that. And turned out to be wrong. It didn't work. When people did 1 over d expansion, didn't work. Another interesting thing which is related to things that we like, which are anomalies, is the following, which is also telling you something curious about the behavior of this turbulent system. So I told you that this Kolmogorov result tells you that... Yes, sure. Yes, the shock waves will dominate. The pressure, what happens is that the pressure term seems to contribute less, so that it relaxes the pressure is the one that tames these shock waves. And the incompressibility conditions becomes irrelevant. It's one equation out of infinite. So we have got various arguments for that. I would, not bet all my money on that, but there is some support from numerics. Maybe there is a clever way to explain that. But this is an open problem, so I'm just pointing it out. It's an important open problem.
So because pressure becomes negligible and therefore shockwave dominates?
Yes, and the shockwave dominates.
But it's not in one dimension.
No, d goes to infinity.
Right.
Right. No, but when shockwaves dominate, then, you can, when you calculate, you see that the first jump is the one that contributes, and therefore it's always linear. Shockwaves, when it's shockwaves, it's always linear contribution. This argument is actually true, what I was saying. The other piece, the other types of contributions give you, do for instance a Taylor series if you want. The shockwaves are the ones that give you the jump in V, they always give you something linear like that, and the rest are the other exponents. It's not a proof. There is a proof for that people have. I mean, there is like a nice paper by Denise Bernard and I think Gavetsky. Who actually calculated for both. But what I'm saying is correct. The other thing which is curious is the following. You could have told me that this should have been zero for the following reason. I'm telling you that in this regime, viscosity is irrelevant. So let's look at the equation without viscosity. This is called, by the way, Euler equation, has a name, when there is no viscosity. This equation has the following symmetry. T goes to minus T, VI goes to minus VI. You see that this is even under there, this is even, and this is even. Now, if this is true symmetry, how come this odd moment doesn't vanish, should have vanished? So this is kind of strange, right? Because I'm telling you on the one hand that viscosity is negligible in that regime. The system of equation has this symmetry. On the other hand, this correlation function is not zero. This is actually the first example of anomaly, of the real type of anomaly that we have in quantum field theory. The reason is the following. This viscosity that is here acts as a regulator. It regulates the system. Of course, this regulator breaks the symmetries. Now, when you send the viscosity to zero, it's like we send this regulator to infinity. But it's not always true that the regulator, when you remove it,
keeps the symmetries of the problem. That's what we call anomaly. There is no choice of a regulator that preserves the symmetry. That's exactly what happens here. Even though you send the viscosity to zero in the calculation, the system does not recover the symmetries without the regulator. So it's really very similar to what we call anomaly, this three-point function being not zero. So the fact that this is actually goes like r to the power 1 is anomaly.
Does it mean that the coefficient tau will be very small compared to delta v to the 4? Both will be r, but the coefficients will be very small. The one.
No, because I think the coefficient, you mean the coefficient in front here?
Yes.
I don't think it's small. I think it has, I mean, like when you have anomaly, the coefficient of, you know, din u j mu 5 is not small, it's determined by instantons.
So the odd and the even ones, they are of the same order.
Of the same order.
And before you said that the pressure was negligible, but maybe it's the viscosity which is negligible in when d goes to infinity, not the pressure.
No, the pressure.
The pressure as well?
The pressure, because what happens is that, you see, when I wrote this Burger's equation, there was no pressure term there, I don't know if you noticed. There is no pressure in that equation. In the Burger's equation, there was no pressure.
Why do you keep the pressure
then? Here?
Yes.
No, it is very important in any dimension, but not when d goes to infinity.
When d goes to infinity, yeah, I thought you were still discussing d going to infinity.
No. This is like...
I'm
sorry. Okay. This is just another... It's another curious result about these anomalous exponents. And the d goes to infinity is different. Yeah. Just tell you that those guys discovered anomaly in turbulence, which is very similar to what we call anomaly in quantum field theory.
Okay, the last, I have like 3 minutes or something, right? Let me tell you one thing that we managed to improve on Kolmogorov, which was, by the way, for the result in that field was very surprising, in the sense that it's different than what you teach in the books, and it allows you to predict all kinds of new results. So Kolmogorov had this story of using this cascade picture, etc., and then you get these exponents. So the first question we started to think about was, suppose I want to consider relativistic systems, which I will discuss later, but anyway, what would be interesting correlation functions to think about? Now, velocities are not interesting because you can change the references, do Lorentz transformation, this, that, maybe it's not. But normally we think about composite operators. So it's okay, let's consider correlation functions of stress tensors. Is it possible that you also have, let's say in the hydrodynamics of n equal to 4, some scaling relations? But then we could not use all these cascade pictures, and then we realized that actually everything comes out from a very simple reasoning. It comes from the fact that in hydrodynamics or in any fluid dynamic system, at the end of the day, the whole equation is some conservation law. That's what it is. Or for instance, in relativistic, it will be d mu, t mu, nu is zero. So for instance, you could have done the same thing if you looked at the Navier-Stokes equation, dt, vi, plus blah, blah, blah. Write it as a conservation law. And then what we noticed is that from this conservation law, if you make the usual assumptions of a scaling regime, of looking for a steady state, scale invariant, isotropic, etc. regime, then there is a very simple way from the equation to derive the scaling relations. So let me just exhibit it on the Navier-Stokes. So what we do is basically say, let's suppose this equation is evaluated at coordinate r or something. And then everything is in R, and multiply it by Vi at zero, sum over the i's, and average, as I said before. So for instance, one averaging could be averaging with respect to the force. When you do that, if you make the several assumptions that you assume about steady state, you derive immediately the Navier-Stokes equation. The scaling relations.
So for instance, let me look at the F1. So here I will multiply and then do some kind of an averaging that I have to. So for instance, here this term, what will happen to it? There will be an Fi at R, Vi at zero. But I'm assuming that I'm in the inertial range. And in the inertial range, the R's are much smaller, smaller than the big scale of the force. So therefore, I can, up to corrections, write this as Fi at zero, Vi at zero, which is some constant which I will call epsilon. I'm in the regime where I can neglect the viscosity. I will neglect the viscosity. When I multiply by Vi with the Pi, and I will use the incompressibility condition, I will kill this term. And then when I will look here, I will have a dt of Vi of R times Vi of zero, but this I can write as a dt of Vi at R, Vi at zero, minus a term which comes from the derivative of time acting on that. But then I will use the Navier-Stokes equation and relate it to that. I will use the steady state condition to remove that. At the end of the day, you will get the following equation. You will get a di of Vj, Dj, Vi, with another Vi that I'll multiply it. I know that it's very quick, but the rough picture is like that. It is equal epsilon. Then I will use isotropy, and I will get a Vj, Vi, Vi, scales like epsilon Ri. And Rj, sorry. And this is actually the Kolmogorov result. Well, if you arrange the indices, etc., it's the Kolmogorov result. But when we realized that, we could derive actually with the usual the same tricks, correlation functions for the stress tensor, correlation functions for other global symmetry currents, correlation and other correlation functions in incompressibility condition case. And they all can derive from a very simple result, that the fact that you can use it as conservation law. So we have lots of predictions that in principle can be checked numerically and experimentally. And they are all based on this simple set of assumptions. I think I passed the time, so, and I'm sorry it was very quick, but you can see it also in the papers. Maybe I should stop. Okay. Thanks.
For general D, is there any reason to believe that psi n is less than 1?
In what?
In general D, is there any reason to believe that psi n is less than 1?
Psi n is less than 1? I don't think there is any example. There is one thing that if you look at correlation functions, this is n equal to 1. Where you put here a fractional number, you will get something less than 1. If that's... Yeah.
But in general dimension, is that graph...
You mean whether it will go
yeah.
here less than 1?
Yeah.
That I don't know an example like that. In fact, I don't know. By the way, the same result that you see here in this Burger's case can be shown also, it will be the case in relativistic hydrodynamics in 1 plus 1. The ones that are dual to non-conformal points, you can also do that.
The holographic map is a bit disappointing by the mean that you don't have some radial realization of this scaling with R, but you just have two balloons dual to two balloons.
Yeah, okay, so that's probably not clear, but what you are saying is of course correct in the sense that there are various ways to see. One way you can say, well, you know, what you are seeing here is actually that there are two nonlinear equations which are the same. One is gravity, describing the evolution of the horizon, and one is
the whatever Navier-Stokes equations, and this has got nothing to do with holography. That's one way to view it. But the second way to view it is a little bit, that might be a right way to use the normalization group. If you think about the regular direction of ABS, okay, let's say this is infinity here. So there is some screen, okay, this is what we call the UV. Then there is the horizon. Let's say this is what you call an IR. And you can actually ask yourself what are the properties of the equation at any screen that you put here. And they are related by a renormalization group in the radial direction somehow. And now comes the question is, if you use if you use the R and you ask, can you separate scales in turbulence? Would it be possible? And that's actually an open problem. The only thing is that is clear, you cannot use ordinary ABS-CFT language in order to calculate things here, because the correlation functions are of a system which is not in equilibrium. And correlation functions of ABS-CFT are tailored to quantum field theory, or field theories at equilibrium. So that you cannot use. But it's not clear that you are not able, you will not be able to use the radial direction in order to separate scales in the turbulent system, and it's not obvious how to do that. It's not clear, for instance, whether with ordinary Wilsonian approach has anything to help you. But it is not true that the radial direction is useless here. It is still important. Still has to be discovered. For instance, if you wanted to go in higher derivative terms above the Navier-Stokes equation, horizon will not be sufficient for you. You really need to go in the radial direction and add more and more corrections until you reach there. So, the one good thing that you can think about it is the opposite. When you discuss QCD using ABS, there are the tools of ABS, but you're not discussing QCD because it's a different model. On the other hand here, when you calculate, you really calculate for the real fluid dynamics that you want of the world, but you cannot use ABS-CFT tool. So, that's it.
If the boundary field theory not would be in a state which you have turbulence on a large ring of scales, mm-hmm. what do you expect the bulk gravity to look like?
So the bulk gravity will exhibit something very similar. I mean, for instance, one thing is if you will look at the horizon, the shape of the horizon, is going to be very, very complicated at the small scales. And that's actually was one of our hopes, because there is one model that I did not discuss. It's a phenomenological model by Parisi and Frisch that explains this interesting numbers, this Xi n, the complicated Xi n, using some multifractal structure. And it came just out of nowhere, and it's not clear why it works, but it somehow works phenomenologically okay or nicely. And what we had in mind is that the horizon of the black hole is actually the quantity that if you probe it at short distances will exhibit this multifractal structure, and therefore their model is just geometrically realized by the black hole. So anyway, just to answer your question again, if there is turbulence in the field theory, the gravity itself will exhibit this very, very complicated fractal structure at short distances.
And if this turbulence takes place on a very large range of scales also, that the radial perturbations of the horizon
enough. It's possible, but it's a tricky. It's possible that the shape. One thing is important. You can still have turbulence even though the derivatives are not very, very large, because you're locally in equilibrium. When people say you're far from equilibrium, they don't mean locally. Locally, you still have a derivative expansion. But so you still have a derivative expansion, but the shape will be very, very complicated. So this, for instance, its motion in the, I mean, when we discuss this, what is important is its embedding in the radial direction. And that will be very complicated. This we'll discuss. This is the extrinsic curvature. The extrinsic curvature will be very complicated. So on any screen, at any length scale that you're going to look, the extrinsic curvature will be very, very complicated. But you don't have fluctuations in the radial direction. See, fluctuations are always in the x and t. The turbulence takes place in the x and t. So you're not going to see something very violent, I think, in the radial direction. But any screen that you will put is going to show you this complicated structure. Maybe when we discuss the gravity, it will be more clear. But the intuition of ABS-CFT is not very, very, very useful.